This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage in the sentencing of Lori Vallow-Daybell and impact statements being given to the court. Let's go back there right now.
Thank you. The type of vibe that was in the courtroom at the time was really hurtful to us. We were unable to be in our feelings and listen to the testimony without having extreme emotion. I'll say it this way. This was a woman who had killed her own children and was on trial for doing that and for killing Tammy. And we felt that she could have had more respect for the family members in the courtroom. Tammy was a most excellent person, and she led her life with the utmost dignity and was beloved not only by our family, but by the community at large. There will be a huge void, and this is Tammy's story, and therefore it's part of our family history. This statement will not be about Lori. It will be about Tammy because it's her story. It's her life that was taken. She was a mom, a grandma, a daughter, a sister, a niece, a cousin, friend, and yes, she was a librarian. But more than a librarian, she was a teacher. She loved her job and went above and beyond for her students. Her last days filled with preparing a book fair for underserved children. I'm sure when she arrived home Friday, October 18th, 2019, she was very tired from a long day and the hours at school. As she got into bed that night, I would imagine she was thinking the same thing as every other night. Nothing more than getting a good night's sleep once her eldest had checked in from his late night job. She had no idea what the plan was for that night or what had been the plan for quite some time. Unbeknownst to her, there had been quite a bit of discussion about how to get rid of the obstacles that Lori had. Lori had already killed two of her children. Tammy was next on her list of obstacle removal. Lori wanted money, sex, and more power. And what Lori wants, Lori gets. The plan was in place on how to get it. Instead of a good night's sleep, Tammy was brutally executed in her own bed. She was taken from us by murdering thieves. Lori sits here, convicted and prepped for prison. And let's be honest, the only question left is for how long. But Tammy was robbed of her entire life. And all of her family robbed of ever seeing her again. Never will she whisper a joke with a friend and laugh. Never see another sunrise or a sunset. Never smell fresh rain or see her grandchildren stomp through a mud puddle. Never to hear being called grandma or mom. Not another birthday, Christmas, birth of a grandchild, or graduation from preschool. No seeing pictures of prom, first dates, or weddings. No searching for something fun to do or growing a garden. Never attending one of our families just for the girls' lunches where we reconnected from all over, laughed about the good old times and the funny way that Grandma Cooper took pictures. And then we'd take photos with each other that we would compare at the next lunch. There would never be another hilarious rendition of Patty and her singing, "Do Your Ears Hang Low?" She'd never wave at a friend as they passed by, make dinner for a sick friend, never have a last conversation with her beautiful mother, or one last kiss goodbye.
have her dad's dad jokes or Samantha's outdoor parties. No more lining up with all of her siblings to get the photo at the next event. A life full of people she loved and who loved her deeply. Her life was snuffed out. To say heartbreaking, gut-wrenching, unbearable is not a big enough statement to convey knowing the way this most excellent existence was taken by planning and execution. The most innocent of lives was simply just discarded like it meant nothing, but it did. And like all of Lucille's grandchildren, her life was a vibe. It was a valiant and unreproachable life. Lori, you participated in the savage murders of precious people of great value and worth. It is most likely something that you would probably never understand, to be selfish and just to live life in a simple way, enjoying life for what it is, to love, to be loved, to smile, and to be smiled at. While you had a shameful relationship with Tammy's husband and planned out a murder, Tammy lived her life. She supported her family in every way. And for you to turn her home where she lived and slept into a cemetery, her two innocent and beautiful children, is one of the most horrific things I can think of. Tammy would have been horrified to know what you had done, and it has broken us as a family. You are now going to pay the price, albeit never sufficient in this life. It's all that we can do. I hope that the life you live is filled with fear and that every day you are terrified, just the way that beautiful Tylee lived in fear for hers and sweet JJ as you continued terrifying her by saying they would be zombies. And she knew the consequences of being what you called dark. Tylee had many wonderful friends that loved her, and in a cruel irony, my granddaughter was a good friend to Tylee. This friend group can still to this day not speak of Tylee freely. They are so stuck in their grief and sadness for their friend who is savagely brutalized and murdered at her mother's hands. It's unconscionable to them, and the grief is still overwhelming. In closing, I would like to thank all of the law enforcement, the FBI, the investigators, the prosecutors, the administration. Everybody has worked so diligently on this case. Especially want to thank those who had to see those things that can't be unseen. We understand your pain also. And grateful for the many, many hours of hard work and dedication and the search for the truth. Thank you, Judge. I trust that you will do the correct penalty for this. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Hoban, thank you for your impact statement. Mr. Wood.
The next victim will be Kay Woodcock.
All right, Ms. Woodcock.
Good day, Judge Boyce. I want to express my thanks and appreciation for being able to speak publicly today on the impact of the defendant's actions. Thank you. 80, 1401, 1481, 1, 72, 1536, 0, 52, 8, 72, 319, and finally 1,000,000. These are more than just numbers and very important numbers and will make sense as I continue. 80 days ago, on May 12, 2023, the word guilty was read for each of the charges inmate Daybell is being sentenced for today. Guilty, the word cemented what I had known for 1,401 days, was returned by the jury. The jury devoted their time, energy, and dedication to deliver justice for J.J. Tiley and Tammy for every single heinous crime charge. Our family is eternally grateful for their sacrifice. Justice would not have been possible without the time, perseverance, and tireless work every member of multiple law enforcement agencies, prosecution team, court personnel, and the court. Our appreciation and thanks can never be expressed in a way that will adequately or effectively convey our gratitude. Today marks 1,481 days that have been filled with terror. One was the day my brother Charles was murdered. It took over 30 hours for the defendant to finally send a cold-hearted text to Charles's sons, informing them that their father was dead. No phone call, no explanation as to how, when, and where. Colin Zack immediately called me, hoping this was a cruel joke.
Your Honor, I'm going to object, as this has nothing to do with this case.
It's overruled, Mr. Thomas. You can continue, Ms. Woodcock.
This was the beginning of her cruel campaign of terror, a campaign that resulted in the deaths of J.J. and Tylee, two innocent children, and Tammy, a devoted mother, grandmother, and wife. Our intense fear for J.J.'s safety began the very moment we learned of Charles's death. We knew Lori didn't want J.J. anymore, as we had seen her abandon him for 72 days with little to no concern of his well-being. We now understand that this was so she could carry on her illicit and tort affair with Chad Daybell and to conspire with him to murder and profit from my brother's death. With the number of divorces in Larry's past, it took me a while to understand why my brother had to die. I now realize what a nothing Chad Daybell is, a man with no ability to support anyone, no success of his own, a user of the weak-minded, a lazy, good-for-nothing, spineless man that rode his wife's coattails of success. After learning of Charles's death, I immediately began reaching out to Lori. I began calling, leaving voicemails, and texting. Finally, after 3 long hours, I received a brief text with 0 details. She couldn't be bothered or felt too guilty to pick up a phone and call, this time his sister, and explain what happened. It set out so many alarms for Larry and I. Within minutes, we were on the phone with an Arizona detective learning the horrifying truths of my brother's murder. This all began with greed, the greed for and desire for a $1 million life insurance policy. She should have answered my calls. She should have spoken to me. I would have given her the money. She could have let JJ and Tylee live and had $1 million. She could have been free to be Chad's mistress and foot the bill with the money from spilled blood. JJ and Tylee could have been with us living happy lives. Instead, she took all that away, all because she is a money-hungry, power-mongering monster. We flew to Arizona the next morning and were finally able to meet with the detective shortly after. We learned the frightful details of my brother being ambushed by Lori and Alex. I know my brother and what we were hearing made no sense to the kind, gentle, and generous and loving man we knew him to be. After hearing the details, our immediate concern was JJ's safety. We had no legal rights to JJ. This simply left our hands tied. We were powerless then and have felt overwhelmingly powerless since. It is the most unwanted and terrible feeling to be in that position. I pray no one ever must deal with this type of circumstance. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. I would say not even Lori or Chad, but their evil and malicious plans are why we are here. She has shown no grief for the lives she willingly took or the pain she caused. Today, I take the power back by standing here speaking out loud of all the pain and loss she caused. I pray that my words will assist you. My sincerest hope is that they will be seriously contemplated in imposing a sentence for her cruel and heinous crimes. During the trial, a lot of information was shared about JJ's death. Today, I want to share how he lived. That is truly the only way to understand and know who he was in the gaping hole his death has left in our hearts and in this world. Todd Trahan came into this world fighting on May 25th, 2012, 10 weeks premature and weighing in at a tiny but mighty 2 pounds and 14 ounces. He was transferred to a hospital with neonatal intensive care unit within minutes of being born, where he spent weeks fighting to grow and live. I remember seeing him for the first time. My son, Todd, his biological father, and I had followed the ambulance to the hospital. He was about 2 hours old when we were finally able to see him. He was so tiny and looked so fragile. In fact, I still have one of his tiny preemie diapers. It fits in the palm of my hand. As soon as I laid my eyes on him, I knew he was my grandson. He was the tiniest version of my son, Todd, who was also seeing him for the first time. Todd struck with the love for him that can't be explained. The love that his new parents can't be put into words. I remember him later saying, "How can I love someone I've never met this much?" It is a feeling I and millions of others have experienced at the birth of a child. Lori, Todd forgives you. I wanted to make sure you know that. While he was in the NICU, I was only able to see him for a few minutes at a time until I was notified he could be released to Larry and I in a few days. When we were initially asked if Kanan could come home with us, Larry and I didn't hesitate and immediately said yes, even though it had been 25 years since I had a new baby at home and never a preemie with their many medical needs. The only place we wanted him to be at home with us was at home with us. The night before he was discharged, I stayed in a little room next to the NICU talking to the nurses and learning all the little things that our little preemie grandbaby would need. The next day, when it was time to leave, the nurse brought a wheelchair in and said, "Have a seat and I'll get you out of here." I looked at her and kind of perplexed. "I don't need a wheelchair. I can walk." She gave me a smile and a little chuckle and then let me know it's hospital policy for discharged babies. So I sat in the wheelchair, took Kanan in my arms and was wheeled out of the hospital just like a new mama. I felt so much pride for this little baby who had not only overcome being born 10 weeks early, but also being born with illicit substances in his tiny little body. He was healthy and ready to come home well before he was expected, and my pride in him knew no bounds. We knew then that he was a champion and oh so very special. That day began an amazing experience of raising our cherished little man. His first night home, as I bathed him, he cried so hard, and I cried right along with him. My heart was so heavy with all that he had been through in just the few short weeks since his birth. After his bath and still crying, my husband Larry, who JJ called Pawpaw, asked me to hand Kanan to him. He placed our baby Kanan on his bare chest and wrapped his robe around him, gently breathing on his head, rhythmically patted his back. Larry kept patting him, breathing warmth onto the top of his head until he finally relaxed, stopped crying, and fell asleep. This became a daily occurrence, part of our routine. He would hold him for hours so that Kanan would feel loved, comforted, and secure. I saw my husband in a new light. Larry jumped in feet first at 65 years old and did all the things a young and new father should and more. It made our relationship grow and gave us a new strength. Kanan was our strength and we were his comfort. His first 6 months were spent going to countless appointments. We went to appointments with doctors, heart, kidney, and urology problems, then to appointments for speech and occupational therapy, as well as visits to other pediatricians for a host of medical problems. We were always going from one appointment to another, constantly working to help him thrive and grow. That, along with loving him, was our number one priority. At each appointment, it became inevitable for me to cry. It deeply wounded me to see him go through so much, but I also felt immense pride in seeing him grow and how much love and happiness he gave to us and everyone that met him. My sister Susan had a special bond with Kanan and spent her days watching him so that I could work. She used to take him for walks, pushing his stroller endlessly. She could get him to belly laugh with silly animal noises, especially the froggy noise. There is no sweeter sound than a baby with an ecstatic belly laugh. Memories of the time watching Kane, spent watching Kanan grow, discovering his hands, toes, and feet, are all Susan has left of that special bond, and the immense grief of his loss is overwhelming. At 6 months old, the time came for the surgery he needed to repair a hernia. Charles and Lori flew to be with us at the Children's Hospital in New Orleans. This is a scary moment in time for us. Our tiny little man was undergoing surgery, and their support meant so much to us. After his surgery, Lori insisted I take the sofa as she slept overnight on the floor of the hospital room. Later, the decision was made to let Charles and Lori adopt Kanan. I knew she would always be 1,000% involved in his care, and I knew it would be okay since I witnessed that. She would always be there to help, support, and care for Kanan. That is part of why this is so hard. How does a woman that would go to that length for a baby boy a few short years later brutally take his life? It is mind-blowing, and I will never understand it. Charles and Lori were granted custody a short time later. It was then Kanan became JJ. It was a happy and devastating at the same time. We loved every minute of raising him. We poured all our love, energy into ensuring he grew and thrived. We knew our unconditional love, and that time was priceless. Kanan's growth and milestones were clear evidence for our love for him. We knew the adoption was the best decision for his future, to have energetic parents, siblings, and access to the types of schools and services we didn't have in Lake Charles, Louisiana. With his departure, we felt a grief that really can only be compared to the grief of losing someone to death, which is now a feeling we all know too well. We had barely made it 30 days before we were standing on Charles's front steps to love on our baby. When the door opened, there he was in his little baby walker, and I swear I saw tears in his eyes at seeing us. He had missed us too. Before I could take a step, Larry swooped him up in his arms, and at 11 months old, JJ wrapped his tiny arms around Larry, laying his head on him. There it was, the connection. It was still so strong. We never lost that special connection with JJ. We were always in love, comfort, and safety. JJ's adoption was final in July of 2014, and Charles and Lauren moved with the kids to Hawaii, living in a house that backed up to a closed golf course, and it was perfect for JJ. It was like having the biggest backyard ever, and it was heaven for him. He would go outside, and he would run and run and run and run, and I ran and ran to chase him and catch up to him. Somehow, he never, ever ran out of energy. JJ also had no fear, and everything was an adventure. He climbed on everything, and he could do it in the blink of an eye. We have pictures sent from Charles of JJ sitting on top of refrigerators and cabinets with a grin on his face. Listening to testimony during the trial and hearing the defendant claim to others that he turned into a demon for doing what he had always done devastates me. How dare she take his energy and adventurous nature and turn it into a reason to further her murderous conspiracy? We would visit Hawaii every 4 to 5 months and stay 10, 14 days. We needed to soak up as much JJ time as we could. On one trip in the winter of 2015, JJ stayed home with me while Charles and Lori went to church. I was making a big pot of gumbo. I had to bring a little bit of Louisiana home cooking to Charles, and JJ was excited to help me. We pulled up a stool. He poured ingredient after ingredient. I can still see him standing next to me pouring chicken broth in the pot. Afterwards, he climbed on the counter and just watched, taking it all in. It is a memory that I will always cherish and dearly hold on to. During our visits, Charles or Lori would comment on how JJ would do things with us that were in stark contrast for them. He always awoke at the crack of dawn, never sleeping any later. However, when we would visit, we would have him sleep with us. JJ would ask Pawpaw to pat his back, just like when he was a baby, and fall asleep. He would sleep until 9 or 10, which astonished them. There was never a doubt. He had an innate and unbroken attachment to us. Each visit, no matter where they lived, Lori always, always expressed her deep appreciation that we gave them the greatest gift ever in JJ. Lori loved to entertain and have family visit, ours and hers. She invited family and friends to Hawaii and friends from Hawaii to Arizona. Zero is the number. That same mother murdered that same child she expressed her deep appreciation for. It is mind-boggling, and I don't think I will ever be able to understand it. Back to JJ, he was incredibly smart. He was reading at middle school level. By the time he was 4, I remember being in a store with JJ and on the aisle with eye drops, and there he was reading off the labels, Visine, Systane, and Antihistamine, one long word after another. I hadn't seen him do that before, so you can imagine my surprise and delight. As we stood there, he would occasionally stumble on a syllable or pronunciation, but we took the time to go through the words and helped him learn. As he got a little older, his special education school in Arizona told Charles he was a math savant. He could calculate anything. I continually wonder what he would have become. What type of man would he be? What did Lori deprive the world of? JJ loved school, loved his family, friends, and cousins, especially his cousin Braxy. The two of them had such a special bond and love for each other. There are so many lives he touched, from family, teachers, neighbors, and church members, that all feel the immense pain and loss of him being gone. Not only was JJ smart, but he was also funny, content, healthy, compassionate, and an empathetic child. JJ didn't show his empathy and compassion with hugs and kisses. In fact, you had to chase him down for those. But instead, with his gentle touch and speaking in soft tones, he would constantly stop to ask people if they were okay, if he could see or sense they were hurt. His world was fascinating and exciting with his huge imagination. He would put on concerts for his stuffed animals under our enormous oak tree, playing the drums on buckets and pots and pans. The joy he exuded and shared cannot be measured. I loved watching him, taking him in, and seeing how he approached the world. I never got enough of him. Now I've had all I will get for the rest of my life, and I will only have the precious memories to cling to. Now memories are how I feel the love I so desperately miss due to the heinous acts of his mother, the deplorable woman that chose to be his mother, the woman that 5 years earlier made the conscious decision to stand in front of a judge and swore to provide for, care, love, and protect him. When Charles and Lori married, Tylee was 3 years old. She was the most precious blonde-haired, blue-eyed little girl. There was never any doubt that Tylee was an absolute mama's girl. When she was little, she adored Lori. I was thrilled to have a new niece, especially one as sweet as her. While Charles and Lori lived in Austin, we visited frequently. On one of our visits, we passed a roadside stand selling swings made from old tires. I saw one that had been made into a horse, complete with a saddle and stirrups. I grabbed Larry's arm and said, "Stop, we have to get that for Tylee." Her brother Kobe and stepbrothers Cole and Zach were always around her, and she needed something girly just for her, and she loved it. As a big sister, Tylee would put notes on her bedroom door, one of them being, "Do not enter." And as you can assume, even though JJ could read and understand the notes, it didn't mean he listened. After all, isn't that what little brothers do? He would storm into her room and she would laughingly tell him to get out. I think she did it on purpose just to tease and play with him. It was hilarious to see them interact and warmed our hearts seeing them together. Tylee was 9 years old when JJ became her little brother. She loved him so incredibly much and he loved her right back.
She doted on him and JJ, loved every minute of attention he got from his big sister. The love they have for each other is captured in the last photo taken of them, both grinning and hugging each other. Hauntingly, this photo was taken shortly before and by the defendant, hours before she murdered her own child, her sweet girl, Tylee. I have a niece that is a few months younger than JJ. Her name is Maddie. She and JJ loved each other and would spend days playing together when Charles and JJ would visit. On her 8th birthday in October of 2020, we were celebrating and singing happy birthday to her. The glow of the candles shining on her face, that huge grin that kids get during the singing, hit me like a truck. I grabbed the keys from Larry and ran to the car, and I just bawled and bawled until I could compose myself enough to rejoin the party. I knew then that JJ didn't get his 8th birthday song, and it broke me. That is how many days it has been since I've seen JJ, and how many days since I was able to see that same candlelit glowing grin and from being sung happy birthday. You see, the last time I was able to hug and kiss JJ was in May of 2019 when we celebrated his 7th birthday. It is just so wrong. He didn't get to have that joy and feeling of love of another birthday because his mother is greedy and his life was expendable to her. We never know when one of those moments are going to hit, but I can tell you that there have been too many situations in the past few years where we get slammed with the fact that JJ won't hit another milestone in his life, all because his materialistic, self-centered mother cruelly and brutally stole his life and him from the world. Lori's acts of depravity, cruelty, and betrayal have no limits. She murdered and stole JJ's daddy from him on July 11th, 2019. Next, she was trying to sell Bailey, JJ's adored and cherished service dog, his shadow and his best friend. When caught, she was confronted and forced to give Bailey back to his original trainer. I can't imagine how that impacted JJ. Bailey went everywhere with him and provided him so much security and happiness. 52. That's how many days after Charles's death she waited, continuing her trail of destruction by taking JJ away from his home, his family, his school, his sense of well-being and normalcy by moving to Rexburg. JJ and Tylee were isolated and deprived of everything and everyone they knew and loved. 8. That's how many days later, until another act of treachery with the murder and desecration of Tylee. The immense sorrow I feel in thinking of JJ's last days and week cannot be measured. How did he cope with the shockwave of change, confusion, and chaos? Being autistic and just a child in general, he thrived and excelled with his routines and schedules, and nothing was routine at that point. How much grief and fear did he experience? The loss of his dad, his world was upside down. During those 2 months, I continually asked to the point of pleading with Lori to let us visit JJ. She only agreed once and then canceled. The trip was for JJ to attend Charles's memorial services back home in Louisiana. Our FaceTime calls, something that had been the norm, were cut shorter and shorter until our last call on August 10th of 2019, that lasted for 35 seconds. This all started with her greed. Her greed for a $1 million life insurance policy and her lust for Chad. 72 days, that is how many days it took Lori to take everything from JJ. He lost his dad, his home, his best friend Bailey, his beloved big sister, and his life. All in 72 days. My sister Susan said it best. She killed him slowly by taking away everything that mattered.
The following 9 months were pure hell. Nothing else can describe the feeling of not knowing where the children were. We were continually learning more about the evil that the defendant was involved with, and our fears continued to mount daily. 319. That's how many days from the last time we were able to FaceTime with JJ until the moment we learned the children had been found in Chad Daybell's backyard, buried like animals. When the call came, a sound escaped me that only can be described as guttural. Our worst fears were confirmed and we were destroyed. The grief my family and I have endured is immeasurable. Lori cruelly took my big brother, Charles, my adorable grandson, JJ, and my beautiful niece, Tylee, and sweet Tammy, whose family I've come to know and love. Lori is undeniably a monster that has not taken any responsibility or shown an ounce of remorse for her vile actions. She deserves to never again breathe oxygen as a free member of society. Her actions, dismissive behavior, and disinterest in court proceedings continue to validate her lack of accountability and remorse or any possibility to be rehabilitated. Lori Cox Daybell is a danger to society. Her body and manipulative mind are weapons used for her selfish greed and satisfaction. We firmly believe that she has zero mental illness.
Sorry, Your Honor, I'm going to have to object. I think the court ruled on this particular portion of her statement. I'm going to ask that the court enforce that.
Give me a moment. Let me review the objection of the written PSI in the court's previous order. The objection's overruled. This is not the section the court struck from the statement, so you can continue, Ms. Woodcock.
We firmly believe that she has zero mental illness that drove her to commit these heinous acts. Rather, she is driven by her greed and need to be the center of attention. During the trial, a jail call was played between Lori and her son, Colby, as she continued her manipulation. Today, it feels especially poignant. Quoting Lori, they have made all these judgments. They think they know what happened. They think they know who's responsible. They think they know everything, but you don't know because you weren't there. And one day you will know. One day you will know what actually happened. Those are her words. It is the one truth that Lori has told since the beginning of her campaign of terror. We do know what actually happened and who is responsible. Lori. Today is the day that she will finally be punished for her manipulation, cruelty, and criminal acts. She has shown no remorse for the murders, the lying, the deceit, or the pain. During the trial, we heard Lori deflect and minimize her sister's grief. We heard her exclaim that she was trying to go on with life, that she needed to be happy, all while she was dancing on the beach and her children were buried in Chad's backyard. Only someone with no remorse tries to justify the cold-blooded murder of her children with her needs. We wholeheartedly believe she was not only complicit, but was an active participant in both JJ and Tylee's murders, making her crimes even more reprehensible. Your Honor, my family and I pray for nothing. Okay. We trust your wisdom in determining the sentence for the fraud. Sorry about that too. Strike that. Okay. We believe there should never be a reason for her to be released from prison. She deprived JJ, Tylee, and Tammy of that right and should never be given what she so easily took from them. I'll leave with two final numbers. Three, for the three people who were murdered, who we will never forget. And finally, the number one for the defendant, the person that will never matter again once we walk out the door.
All right, Ms. Woodcock, thank you for the victim impact statement. Mr. Wood, are there any other statements to be offered into the record?
Yes, Your Honor. We have been asked to read Colby Ryan's statement into the record, and so I'll do that now.
Very well.
As the older brother to Tylee Ryan, J.J. Vallow, and the son of Charles Vallow, I want to say the generations have been affected by these murders. My children will never know their uncle, their aunt or grandfather, or even their own grandmother. Tylee and J.J. brought so much light into this world. With their lives being stolen, I would like to share this. I believe that nothing could or will ever be the same. Tylee will never have an opportunity to become a mother, wife, or have the career she was destined to have. She'll never be able to have the life she deserved. JJ will never be able to grow and spread his light with this world the way he did. He will never have a chance to grow up. My girls will never have a chance to know them in this life. My siblings and father deserve so much more than this. I want them to be remembered for who they were and not to be just a spectacle or a headline to the world. Tylee was sweet and kind, funny and bold, and she deserves to be seen as such. JJ was the most fun, sweet, and silly kid I'd ever known, loving and so smart. He deserves to be seen as such. Charles was a loving, kind, and generous father, and he did everything he could to help and provide for everyone around him. He deserves to be seen as that. This has affected me personally more than I could ever possibly put into words. I've lost my entire family in life. I lost the opportunity to share life with the people I love the most. I've watched everything crumble and be shredded to pieces. I have lost my sister, brother, father, and my mother. I've lost cousins and family, friends, and everything in between. These murders have changed everyone's life who loved these beautiful people, but I still know that God is above holding them in his arms and will provide a life after this to reunite. I pray for healing for everyone involved, including those who took the lives of all the ones we love. Thank you.
All right, the court's considered that statement as well at this point then. Mr. Wood, are there any other victim impact statements to read into the record?
No.
Very well. At this time then, as I mentioned, I'll move forward and have the state make its sentencing recommendations. After that, then the defense may make their recommendations. So, Mr. Wood, you can commence with the state's sentencing recommendation at this time.
Thank you. Your Honor, I want to start with the question. What is the value of a human life? What is the value of the life of a 16-year-old girl with her life ahead of her? What is the value of a life of a 7-year-old boy with special needs? What is the value of the life of a mother and a grandmother? No matter how we look at what we are doing here today, we are calculating and assigning a value for the lives of Tylee Ryan, J.J. Vallow, and Tammy Daybell. The defendant, now a convicted murderer, by her heinous and egregious acts, has assigned a value of zero to each of these lives. The sentence imposed by the court today will represent the value that our community, through our court, places on the lives of these three victims. To the people of Idaho, this day should be more about the victims than the defendant. This court has multiple factors it must consider today, including the sentencing factors found in Idaho Code 19-2521. Justice requires the court to view all of the factors it will consider through the lens of the value of the lives of Tylee, JJ, and Tammy. We echo the sentiments made by the victims or in the victim impact statements, and we just briefly speak about these immediate victims. Tylee Ryan was born on September 24th of 2002. She was murdered between September 8th and 9th of 2019. People who knew her called her witty, charming, intelligent. She'd received her GED in order to graduate early. We know she often cared for her brother. In evidence, we had videos of her with him, and she would call him my JJ. She loved Hawaii. She loved the beach. She had friends and family who loved her very much on both her father and her mother's side. Her father was Joseph Ryan, who predeceased her in 2018. Her older brother is Colby Ryan, with whom she shared a special bond. After Joseph Ryan died, Tylee, as this court knows, was the recipient of Social Security benefits. And she actually shared a lot of those with her brother, Colby, because that's the type of person she was. In serving search warrants, we accessed her Instagram account, where we learned that she was intensely loyal to her own mother. From her finances, we know she was a typical teenager. She liked to have fun. She was also independent and responsible. JJ Vallow was born May 25th of 2012, and he was murdered between September 22nd and 23rd of 2019. As we heard earlier, he was initially born as Kanan Todd Trahan in less than ideal circumstances and was initially raised by his grandparents. He was then adopted by the defendant and her husband, Charles Vallow. He was loved by his family and friends. He loved to travel. Tammy Daybell was born May 4th, 1970, and she was murdered on October 19th, 2019. She was a mother of five children, and she's now a grandmother. She was a school librarian and educator. We know from her phone and from witnesses, she loved her children intensely. She was physically active, and she was kind. This court laid out the procedural history of the case. I'm just going to briefly touch on some dates that are important to the state and we think are important in terms of sentencing. The defendant met Chad Daybell in October of 2018, and within a year, her husband Charles Vallow was dead, her children were dead, and her boyfriend's wife was dead. In late August, early September of 2019, the defendant moved to Rexburg with Tylee and JJ and her co-conspirator and brother Alex Cox. Tylee was last seen on September 8th, 2019, and JJ was last seen September 22nd, 2019. Tammy Daybell was last seen on October 19th. On November 5th, barely more than 2 weeks after Tammy was murdered, this defendant married her co-conspirator, Chad Daybell. November of 2019, Rexburg police were contacted regarding a Jeep that was involved in a shooting in Maricopa County, Arizona. Later that month, JJ Vallow was reported missing, and an investigation was furthered into Tammy's death, and law enforcement became aware that Tylee was missing. On December 12th, Tammy Daybell was exhumed. The next day, Alex Cox, one of the defendant's co-conspirators, died in Arizona. At the end of that December, the search for the children became public, and there was no response from the defendant or her co-conspirator. In January of 2020, the defendant was served with an order to produce children, and there was no response. Charges were filed for abandonment of minor children. And I want to be clear, the defendant had a right to silence. She did not have a right to disobey the order of the court to produce the bodies of her children. The Rexburg Police, the Fremont County Sheriff's Department, the FBI, the Idaho Attorney General's Office devoted thousands of hours of work into looking for Tylee and JJ and into investigating the death of Tammy Daybell. On June 9th, 2020, Tylee and JJ were found in the defendant's husband's backyard. On May 24th of 2021, the defendant was indicted by a grand jury for the crimes of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Tylee Ryan and grand theft by deception, the murder of Tylee Ryan, the conspiracy to commit murder, first-degree murder of JJ Vallow and grand theft by deception, the murder of JJ Vallow, the conspiracy to commit murder of Tammy Daybell and grand theft. And the defendant was convicted by a jury of her peers in Ada County on all counts on May 12th of this year. This court is required to consider the factors in Idaho Code 19-2521 subparent A in sentencing. And that particular statute reads, the goals of sentencing include the primary consideration of the protection of society, followed by the possibility of risk reduction through rehabilitation, deterrence of the individual and the public generally, and punishment or retribution for wrongdoing and the impact on the victim. I want to talk about protection of society. This defendant has proven by her actions that she is dangerous to society. In Idaho alone, she was involved with 3 murders in a space of 6 weeks. While she's not convicted yet, I think the court can acknowledge that she faces 2 charges of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder in Maricopa County. 2 of the murders in Idaho were her own children. This defendant violated the most sacred trust that exists in society, that between a mother and her children. And she did it for gain. She did it for money. A defendant who is willing to murder her own children is willing to murder anyone. Society can only be protected from this defendant by a life sentence without the chance of parole. There is no indication that upon murdering for financial gain that she feels any remorse. The amount of murders in her ledger show us she will seek to obtain money through murder again if released. And again, only a sentence of life without parole will satisfy the court's mandate to protect society. Court's required to consider risk reduction through rehabilitation. And it's tempting to just say there's no rehabilitation possible. What is rehabilitation? It's the process of restoring a person to normal and a constructive place in society. Some crimes render a criminal unable to fully be rehabilitated as a functioning member of society. Some crimes are so heinous that you simply lose your place among the rest of us. Killing your own children and your boyfriend's wife are these types of crimes. Rehabilitation requires remorse and acceptance of responsibility. And there is literally zero evidence that this defendant feels remorse or responsibility for her crimes. The court heard victims talk about her behavior at trial, and I think that was an indicator that she lacks remorse, that she lacks accountability. The only way to rehabilitate this defendant at any level is to make her face the consequences of her heinous crimes that she has committed. And that is only possible through a sentence of life in prison without any chance of release. This court is required to consider deterrence of the individual and the public. Again, deterrence requires accountability. She has none. One thing that has been so shocking about these crimes is where it happened. Fremont and Madison County, Idaho. These are fairly rural areas. These are low crime areas. And I would note that this defendant, despite being labeled oftentimes by the media as a Rexburg, Idaho mother, is not a Rexburg, Idaho mother. She's not from Rexburg. She actually spent very little time here before she was arrested. And our community was left reeling by these crimes. The sentence that the court imposes today will be a message. And the citizens of these 2 counties have a right to the message, don't come here and commit these crimes. The citizens of these counties don't live these type of lives. And we don't want people to come here and commit these crimes. And this court has a responsibility to send that message, to give a sentence that gives that deterrence. It's the state's position that only a sentence of life without parole will send the proper message of deterrence both to this defendant and the public. And in line with deterrence, if these crimes don't merit that type of sentence, the state's unaware of what kind of crimes would. Finally, the court is required to consider punishment and retribution and the impact on the victim. The obvious impact of the defendant's crimes against Tylee Ryan, J.J. Vallow, and Tammy Daybell was death. And we can't ask Tylee, J.J., and Tammy about that experience because they're gone. They don't have a voice. We can't ask them what it felt like to be murdered. We can't ask them about the impact of their last moments. We have to instead look at the evidence and glean what we can regarding the impact of the murder of Tylee, J.J., and Tammy. This court sat through a trial. This court saw the same evidence that the state saw, that the defendant saw, that the jury saw. This court was the custodian of that. And so this court has seen how horrific these crimes were. And I want to talk individually about the impact of these crimes on these victims. So what was the impact on Tylee? We don't even know how she died. And why is that? Because her body was mutilated, it was dismembered, and it was burnt beyond recognition. We only know for a surety that it was her because of DNA testing. Her body was utterly destroyed, and she was buried in a pet cemetery next to animals. Her skull was literally separated from her body, and it was destroyed in such a manner we couldn't even tell 100% from dental records if it was her. The defendants put her body in a green bucket that melted from the heat of her burning flesh and put it on top of her skull in a pet cemetery. The impact of this crime on this victim was horrendous. We know she had puncture wounds in her pelvis, and we know from the testimony of Dr. Christensen at trial that those puncture wounds were received at or near the time of death, and they were consistent with stabbing, but not consistent with dismemberment. Again, the impact of the murder of Tylee was horrendous. And this impact will continue. Tylee will never get to become a mother, as we heard earlier. She will never have the opportunity to go to college. She won't get to choose a career to satisfy her curiosity or make any of the other decisions that young adults get to make for themselves. She won't get to travel the world. She won't get to marry. She won't get to be there for her brother Colby or her brother JJ. She won't get to spend time with her other family members. The impact of murder never ends. So the defendant's sentence must last equally as long. I want to talk about the impact on JJ Vallow. Again, we can't speak to him, but we've seen the evidence. We know that he died from asphyxiation from duct tape and a plastic bag wrapped around his head. The evidence showed that there was a struggle. And what was the impact on that little boy's mind as he fought for his life? His last moments must have been filled with fear and betrayal. And what is the impact of being buried like a piece of trash rather than receiving a proper burial? This defendant and her co-conspirators showed a callous disregard for human life by the demeaning way they treated his and his sister's bodies. Similar to Tylee, JJ will never get to grow up. He will never be able to reach his potential. He won't spend time with family, friends, and loved ones. What was the impact on Tammy Daybell? This defendant was not charged with the actual murder of Tammy Daybell, but she was charged with the conspiracy to murder her. and convicted of such charge. I would note conspiracy is not a lesser included of murder. It is an equal charge. We know that because the sentencing by statute is equal. It is equally as bad to conspire to murder as it is to murder. It's bad enough to steal someone else's spouse. This crime rose to a whole other level of egregiousness because this defendant planned with her boyfriend the death of his wife. And when her brother and boyfriend committed that actual murder, she was vacationing on a beach in Hawaii. We don't know exactly what Tammy's last moments were like. We can't ask her. We know she had bruising on her body that appeared to be at or near the time of death. Like Tylee, like JJ, the impact on this victim continues. She won't get to spend time with her children. She can't give them advice. She can't be there for her grandchildren, her brothers, and her sister. She missed her mother's funeral. But the impact doesn't end with the individual and immediate victims. It spreads. It's the proverbial rock thrown in the lake that ripples and ripples and ripples. Murder tears at the fabric of society more than any other crime. Infanticide defies the law of nature. Mothers are meant to care for their children. When we consider the impact of the victim, it's appropriate for this court to consider the impact on the living victims as well. So when we talk about punishment, it has to match the crime. Not only do we need to protect society, do what we can to rehabilitate and deter, the punishment has to match the crime. Punishment must be, because this was the ultimate crime, killing your own children, killing your boyfriend's wife, the punishment must be the ultimate allowed by the law. And at this time, that is life sentences without parole. And we aren't asking that to be harsh. We're asking that because it's the right thing to do, because it's the only punishment that matches what this defendant did. I want to just briefly address some of the material found in the PSI. There are two mental health reports, one by Dr. Watson and one by Dr. Cunningham. Excuse me. And so what's in them? They say that this defendant suffers from a delusional disorder. She has grandiose and persecutory features, which I would note is something that many serious criminals have. It says she has hyper-religiosity with bizarre beliefs. More important, though, than what's in those reports, I want to talk about what's not in them. These are bare-bones reports with barely anything more than alleged diagnosis. There's no analysis of her behavior, and that's important to know, because psychologically, we can tell more from what a person does than what they say. There's zero evidence provided or in those reports that the defendant's alleged mental illness contributed to her crimes. There's zero evidence in those reports that the defendant's alleged mental illness hindered her ability to know right from wrong. And in fact, the evidence is overwhelming that she did know right from wrong. She lied to the police. She lied to family members, and she lied to friends regarding the children of Tammy. Even their close friends, who they shared some of these religious beliefs with, they lied to about the death of the children. And what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that Tylee and JJ didn't die because their mom thought they were possessed. If she truly believed that, she would have preached it, because she preached all the time. She didn't tell anyone that because she knew why she killed them. She killed them for money. Her actions show afterwards, not a pattern of grieving. She goes. one prognosis. It states the defendant will make a positive adjustment to prison. Well, that's good because that's where she belongs and that's where she needs to go. Other than that, there's no treatment suggestions or discussion of possible treatment. Again, we'd ask this court to look at the defendant's behavior more than anything she says. At trial, the defense made it clear that they see Chad Daybell as the primary antagonist and that he should be blamed for these crimes and not the defendant. That was in the closing. I want to be very clear. This court is precluded today from even engaging in any analysis of that. Chad Daybell's guilt has not been determined yet, and this court cannot engage in some type of balancing analysis of guilt when he must be presumed innocent by this court until proven guilty. Upon being proven guilty, we can have that conversation, but not now. And further, even if he had been determined guilty, this defendant was charged with conspiracy. This is not a comparative fault case. On a conspiracy, if you're in for a penny, you're in for a dollar. And there's an important societal reason. There's an important reason that society has done that. It's bad enough when a person decides to commit a crime, especially one that includes victims. When a person teams up with another person and they agree to commit crimes, they become infinitely more dangerous. And so there is no comparative guilt. There is no comparative liability. This defendant has been found guilty by a jury, and that's all the court can consider in that regards. I would note this case is a perfect example of why we punish conspiracy the way we do, because of the damage that arose from these agreements to murder. So, Your Honor, for the sentence that the state recommends, before I state that, I ask this court to remember the victims. And what does justice for Tylee, JJ, and Tammy require? I note that the PSI made a recommendation, and it states, on January 3rd, 2023, the defendant's attorney filed a motion indicating they did not intend to raise a mental health defense. However, if she was convicted, they plan to submit information in support of mitigation during sentencing. It seems important to note that while she has been diagnosed with a mental illness, she had the mental capacity to fabricate a story regarding the whereabouts of her children, change Tylee's Social Security payments to her own account, plan a wedding to Mr. Daybell in Hawaii, attend a family vacation with Mr. Daybell's family, lie to them about not having minor children, and relocate to Hawaii. She did all this with the knowledge her children's bodies were buried on Mr. Daybell's property. Those closest to the defendant describe her as a loving and devoted mother. They indicate both children loved her very much. A mother is meant to protect her children. However, the defendant has been found guilty of the brutal murder of her children. The focus should be that three innocent people, Tylee, JJ, and Mrs. Daybell, were murdered. The sheer devastation of all the lives impacted by her abhorrent actions warrants punishment. Therefore, it is recommended she be sentenced to a period of incarceration under the custody of the Idaho State Board of Correction. As this court is aware, PSI writers don't give specific recommendations for what time an individual should spend in prison, but the state does have that. This court is aware that the state's position has always been that justice requires this defendant face the highest level of punishment for her crimes, which at this point is a life without parole sentence. The heinous nature of her crimes and the aftermath of those crimes show an utter and callous disregard for human life. She committed these crimes for remuneration and financial gain, and she has shown no remorse or accountability, and she sees herself as being above the law. She has shown contempt for these proceedings and the process of justice for her children and for Tammy Daybell. At this time, the ultimate punishment is fixed life sentences without the chance of parole. And so specifically, for count one, for the conspiracy to murder Tylee Ryan and commit grand theft, the state asks and requests a sentence of fixed life without the chance of parole. For count two, the murder of Tylee Ryan, the state requests a sentence of fixed life without the chance of parole to run concurrent with the fixed life sentence for count one. For count three, the conspiracy to murder J.J. Vallow and to commit grand theft by deception, the state requests a sentence of fixed life without the chance of parole to run consecutive to the fixed life sentences for counts one and two. Consecutive sentences are justified here by the severity of the crimes, the fact that it involves different victims, and there was an appreciable amount of time between the murders of Tylee and J.J. For count four, the murder of J.J. Vallow, the state asks for a sentence of fixed life without the chance of parole to run concurrent with the fixed life sentence for count three, but consecutive to the fixed life sentences for counts one and two. For count five, the conspiracy to murder Tammy Daybell, the state requests a sentence of fixed life without the chance of parole to run consecutive to the fixed life sentences previously requested. And for count seven, grand theft, the state requests the full sentence of 20 years. Pursuant to Idaho Code 195307, we request a fine of $5,000 to be paid to the next of kin of Tylee and JJ. I would note that Idaho Code 19-5307 includes a list of crimes, violent crimes, for which that payment to a victim may be granted. And it includes murder, but does not include conspiracy to commit murder. However, we'd also note that under Idaho Code, the punishment for murder is the same as the punishment, or I'm sorry, the punishment for conspiracy is the same for the punishment to commit murder. And so we'd ask for a $5,000 fine to be paid to the next of kin of Tammy Daybell. We'd ask for an order of restitution to the United States of America Treasury in the amount of $22,545, which amount was proven at trial to be the amount that was stolen from the Department of Treasury. I would note, Your Honor, compared to these other crimes, a grand theft does not seem like a big deal. But I would note that in context of these crimes, this grand theft is a big deal. It shows her contempt, not only for her children, shows her contempt for everybody else, because that money belongs to everyone. Finally, pursuant to Idaho Code 18-112, we would ask for fines of $50,000 for each count of conspiracy and murder for a total of $250,000 in fines. The state has essentially asked for the maximum sentence allowed under the law. The sentence is not only justified, it is necessary to satisfy the four goals of sentencing in Idaho. A sentence less than what the state has requested will not satisfy those goals. And I want to end, Your Honor, where I began. What is the value of a life? What is the value of Tylee Ryan's life? What is the value of J.J. Vallow's life? And what is the value of Tammy Daybell's life? Our communities and the people we represent, the value is great, it is immense, and it is immeasurable. No sentence given today will bring those victims back to their loved ones. There is no true justice for murder, so we have to do the best we can. And any sentence that would allow this defendant to even hope for release from prison would send a message that these communities don't value the victims' lives appropriately. Again, in regarding the goals of sentencing, we request this court make its decision pursuant to those goals and through the lens of what justice requires for Tylee, JJ, and Tammy. These crimes were heinous. They were egregious. Again, she murdered her own children. They had a right to depend on her. Tylee and JJ had a right to be protected by her. She betrayed their trust in the most awful and horrific way imaginable. She profited from those murders. The defendant conspired to murder her boyfriend's wife. It wasn't enough to steal or to break the marriage. She wanted Tammy dead. And why? Well, there were $430,000 that they profited from that. And so what does justice for Tylee, JJ, and Tammy require? It requires that this defendant never have a chance for freedom because her victims no longer have that. This defendant forfeit the remainder of her life to prison because her victims were forced to forfeit their lives. What is the value of a life? Thank you.
All right, Mr. Wood, there was just one point of clarification I wanted to have on the grand theft recommendation. You recommended a 20-year sentence on that, and I just wanted to clarify. I believe the maximum possible under Idaho's grand theft statute is 14 years.
That's correct, Your Honor. I apologize. It is 14 years. We would ask for the maximum 14 years.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wood.
Oh, Your Honor?
Yes.
We'd like to double check that. I think it might have changed. Your Honor, I believe that has been changed to 20 years.
And I think is that only if it's by extortion? I think there may be a limitation. I'll double check, counsel. And allow the defense to comment on that as well when they have their opportunity to speak. All right, we'll consider the recommendations of the state submitted at this time. I'm going to take a mid-morning break at this point. We do have a court reporter that has to take down all of this verbatim, which is a large task, and others may need to use the restroom. I'll note that given all of the people here, the facilities we have, that it will take some time. So I'll plan on a 30-minute recess, and then I'll have the defense, if they're ready, to make their recommendations after the recess. Is that all right, Mr. Thomas?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll take our recess then, and we'll continue with the recommendations of the defense after break. And let me just indicate, we'll have the audience and those in the gallery please wait while we have the defendant escorted out for security purposes. Once the bailiffs have given you the word that it's okay to exit the courtroom, you can do that, but please remain where you are until that.
There's more to come in the sentencing of Lori Vallow Daybell, including Lori herself addressing the court. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast.
The Hidden Killers Podcast.
With Tony Bruschi.